The forest fills you with its own being. It feeds you. It gives you food from its own mouth. In the eyes of the Baka, every animal hunted, every fish caught or fruit picked, is like an offering, a sacrifice that the forest makes of itself, a gift to be thankful for. Pygmies.org. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I appreciate your continued support to all our returning listeners, and if this is your first time, I appreciate you stopping by. I hope that you will enjoy and that you'll continue listening and maybe go back and listen to our backlog. All the support, it really means a lot. So, this week, we are getting back in our regular swing of things, and we'll be moving north into Central Africa's rainforests and the peoples there before talking about people living south of the Sahara and Sahel regions in the western extension of the African continent. And this section will probably take two or three more episodes after this one. To start, though, we're going to talk about the peoples living in the rainforests and Congo River basins. Now, like the people living in the southern part of the continent, these people are relatively isolated from outsiders, and in many cases also from each other. How many of these groups existed, we're not sure of. Of course, because of the tropical environment, artifacts, and DNA sources from earlier periods can be very difficult to find and test. But from what we can tell in terms of modern descendants, there were at least three populations that are genetically distinct from each other and all with their own subgroups. Sorry for that. there may have been more whose DNA we don't have access to and thus can't see if they have, you know, any living descendants. Of course, it's also possible that these people existed and that they have no living descendants. Why they or their descendants died out is possible due to a number of factors that we will deal with in future seasons, but all of these reasons stem primarily from the fact that they were probably, like the three remaining macro groups of Central African foragers, pygmies. Now, I've used the term pygmy in prior episodes, and I'll just reiterate that it is seen by many as a pejorative, and there are efforts by some to create a new term. And there are those that will occasionally use Central African foragers, African rainforest hunter-gatherers, or forest peoples of Central Africa. These are fairly new terms and generally are only used by specialized academics. You might see archaeologists use one, anthropologists use others, though there are problems with each of these terms because they don't all quite apply to all of the various groups that make them up. And then there's some cases where there are non-pygmy peoples who have moved into the region afterwards that some of these terms kind of also describe, but they're not here now at this season's time frame. Now the term pygmy entered English from the Latin pygmei, which is the singular for pygmeus, which came from the Greek pygmeoi, which is the plural of pygmeos. Is related to the Greek word for cubit, pichis, which derives from the word for fist, pygme. Now, a cubit, for those that aren't aware, was a very popular measurement in the classical Middle East and Mediterranean Sea area. And it, of course, predates even the classical period as well. All with slightly different lengths depending on the people that are using the term, but generally it can be meant, or it is meant as the length from the tip of the middle finger all the way down to the bottom of the elbow. Now, all this said, of course, the various pygmy groups in Africa don't really have too much of an issue with the term. Or if they do, they have much more pressing issues to deal with than what a bunch of academics call them. And we will talk more about these issues in the future. Also, unlike some groups in Australia, like Aboriginal groups, they don't necessarily feel any deep kinship or connection between the various different pygmy groups. They're still tribal, mostly, and their primary concerns are for their own peoples, those that they share a common language and region and kinship that way. Now, one of the shared challenges that all these peoples and their ancestors faced, though, is health and diet. Now, when I've talked about these peoples in the past, I did mention that we're not 100% sure when they evolved their smaller statures. And there is some debate, if this is a very long-term development, if this has happened well before this season, or if it is something that's relatively recent. But I do think that wherever the academics stand, I think by and large, I don't think anyone thinks that they become shorter on average after this season. I think this season is the absolute latest. And I'm of the opinion that they were probably pygmies at the very least by the start of last season. But that is not 100% confirmed, and it's still debated. It's kind of hard to tell with, the very difficult task of obtaining DNA sources from this region. But I did read a very interesting article between the last time we talked about these peoples and this episode, and it went into a little bit more detail on why this, why they may have evolved this way. And part of it is, of course, that there is the fairly common trace that you see with insular dwarfism, populations that are isolated from each other or from, outside groups that they, theoretically could interbreed with. That doesn't happen, and thus they begin to shrink. This has happened not just to humans, and not only to humans in Africa. Again, there are peoples in the island Asia where they do develop smaller statures, but there are instances on Cyprus with pygmy elephants. There are other species that do go through this insular dwarfism. So one of the more popular theories is that, these peoples were living in the forest. There wasn't a lot of room for them to necessarily navigate if they were, of an average Homo sapien size, so that they developed this smaller stature to help them travel through this densely forested region of Central Africa. But I did read an article. It's from 2009, and it was authored by Price et al., and it was entitled Sensitive Detection of Chromosomal Segments of Distinct Ancestry in Admixed Populations. And this was done by a number of scientists and researchers. And essentially what they found is that one of the possible reasons that they developed the smaller stature is because they had diets that was lacking in, or that were, excuse me, that were lacking in iodine. Now, the body needs iodine to make thyroid hormones. And these hormones control, you know, a number of features, but most importantly is a body's metabolism. And, you know, lack of iodine deficiency is still a big problem in a lot of places in the world. And this study pointed out that they found that FA pygmies and their neighbors, Lesse, who are descendants of a different group of Africans who migrate into the region later, Bantu people, and they are what you would consider a normal or an average size for Homo sapiens. They have very similar diets, more or less. But because of the area that they live in, the jungles and tropics of Africa, there are not a lot of good sources of iodine in food. So the Lesse, the descendants of people who move into this region later, they have, you know, a higher frequency of health problems associated with iodine deficiency. Specifically, goiters, which are those, occasionally you'll see them, they're growths that will grow around the neck, is probably one of the more noticeable defects of having an iodine deficiency. Whereas the FA pygmies, they are much more resistant to that type of disease. And in fact, children with mixed parentage, they do show kind of a middle ground in terms of percentage of those people who, or those two peoples, I should say. They kind of had a middle ground in terms of how susceptible they are to things like goiters. So that is one thing. That's fairly recent. I think there's going to be more studies done on this, but that is one factor that may have led to this shorter stature. Their bodies have adapted to having less iodine. So, but one of the things that that may have suffered is their growth hormones. Which, of course, is one of the things the thyroid helps produce. So they may be more resistant to goiters and things like that. They may escape some of the more extreme health defects, but they still might have suffered from overall height, if I guess is one of the trade-offs that they have. Now, that also, of course, does lead them to have typically shorter lifespans than other Homo sapiens. The study also did kind of confirm what, you know, had reasonably been suspected from other DNA studies, showing that the FA, who are, I think, Mbuti is like the overall group that they are part of, developed this trait independently of the Biaka people, who are an Mbanga group of pygmies. There are three, as I said, kind of larger pygmy groups, and these are two that are separated by a, you know, fairly large distance. The Mbanga are closer to the west coast of Africa. I think they occupy parts of modern day Cameroon and the Republic of the Congo. I think they are around the Deja and Ngoku rivers, which are kind of in that border region of those two countries. I believe they also occupy small parts of the Central African Republic, and possibly the Gabon too. Now, I said they were towards the west coast, but they're closer towards the west coast, but they are still inland people. They are very comfortable in the forests and the rivers of the forests. They are not coastal people. they are an inland people, whereas the Mbuti, they are kind of towards closer towards the center of the continent, and they are mostly found in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which, yes, is different than the Republic of the Congo. They are associated with the Ituri forests, and there are a couple of rivers that are all part of the Congo River system. And those are two of the three groups. The other is the Batwa, and they are a little bit further south, and they are kind of, south and again towards kind of the center. They are in, I think, Rwanda, Burundi, also in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Tanzania, Uganda. They have a much wider distribution than the other two. But again, all are genetically different from each other. But at this point in time, despite the lack of apparently certain minerals and things like that, they are still very populous, at least in terms to everyone else. I think after the Khoi and the San, they're probably the most populous group of humans, at least for another 1,000 years or so, if not a little bit more. Again, estimating populations at this point is a little difficult. There was one thing with the Twa or the Batwa, depending on who's talking about them. Some of them are not necessarily always included with other pygmies. They can be somewhat taller than other pygmies, though on average they are shorter than their non Twa neighbors. But I think they can get up to around 5 feet, which is 155 centimeters. Not as short as some of the others, but again, not quite the average of other Homo sapiens in other areas. And even, again, their Bantu descended neighbors who, of course, move into the region later. Now, unfortunately, in terms of language, there is not a lot known. There's no kind of pygmy language family that make up all these groups. Again, because of issues we're going to talk about later, a lot of their languages share a lot of words with their neighbors, especially their agricultural practicing neighbors. I think certain groups only have around maybe 30% of their vocabulary that is theirs, that is not related to any of their neighbors' languages. And all of these words relate to things that they've presumably been doing before they had any kind of agriculture or trade with agriculturalists. They don't have words for things the agriculturalists brought into the region and were growing themselves, but they do have things related to their home, the forests. Things that relate to harvesting wild plants and berries and nuts and fish that they catch, or honey. Honey gathering is something that they've been doing for quite some time. Now, there have been people that have, put forward the idea that there were at least some pygmy groups had some type of, common ancestral tongue, but that's not been proven at all, and that there are people that, very stringently disagree with that. Unfortunately, we will probably never know. Now, the forest is, of course, extremely important to these people, as you might suspect from the quote I read, which is from the website. It's pygmy.org. It is kind of an informational site where information on different African pygmy groups, where you can find information on them. It's put up by, I think, some pygmy peoples have added to it, and then there are some people who are, friends of the pygmies and who would like to see them have a better standard of living. And again, this is getting way ahead of ourselves, but there are people who do try to help them. There are those that have at least introduced the idea of seasonal agriculture to them, where they will plant crops in certain areas and they'll leave and they'll come back later, and then they can harvest kind of these wild strains. But by and large, they are still fairly mobile. In terms of this season and this time frame, very traditional hunter-gatherer societies like the Sequoia and the San, but because that they are, even though they have much more interaction these days with agricultural groups, they do still practice these small family bands kind of hunting in the forests. From what we can see, they're a fairly egalitarian society in terms of division of labor. Women hunt, men forage. They share child-rearing responsibilities. There are some women who are very good hunters and who will hunt, in some cases, up until if they're pregnant. There are some women who have, gone on hunts while heavily pregnant, at least according to some anthropologist reports. That being said, though, they do, while they do kind of have a collective form of leadership, they kind of all talk about what they think their groups should do for a period of time. They do have, I guess, kind of a chief or like a hunter who specializes in a specific type of game. These roles are almost entirely held by men, but it doesn't appear that, women are excluded. It's just for whatever reason the title is mostly held by men. Now that may be, due to them interacting with, later groups in the area who were very patriarchal, and maybe they realized that these men would not negotiate with women or would treat women lesser. I don't know. I haven't read any anthropological literature on that. But it is something to consider. Now, as I said, and as I quoted from that website at the start, the forest is very important to the pygmies. It's not necessarily a god to them, but it is, in some ways, kind of like the hypothetical earth goddess, the earth mother that you see a lot of, or that people postulate that a lot of early agriculturalists were worshiping. To them, the forest is a living thing. It's a single kind of single organism that gives them everything that they need. And I think a lot of these groups, if something bad's happened to them, and this is, I think, kind of across all of the different regional, subgroups, if something bad happens to them, they typically think that the forest is asleep. Is a term that I read that some of them use. And to that end, they like to make sure that the forest is always awake. Music is very important to all of these people. The Mbanga, the Mbudi, they will make music with, all kinds of instruments. They will use just anything they can find that makes a noise that they find appealing. They will kind of all use them in very inventive ways to make as much sound as possible. you know, to just make sure the forest is awake and, you know, that they know, or that the forest knows that they're there and that they're happy with it and they want to continue to receive its bounty and blessings. Now, there are, you know, probably other reasons. Obviously, humans are able to identify sounds reasonably well. And I think, you know, if you're a human and you're walking and you hear another human making sound, you're going to appreciate that and know it's not like some type of predatory cat stalking you in the jungle, that it's just a human that's nearby. You'll know it's not some type of animal getting ready to charge the brush. You know it's a human and he's walking and he's just communicating to the forest, but also letting other people know that, yes, I'm human. I'm not anything that's, you know, an out and out danger to you. Now, I did read a little bit of a book. It's The Forest People. It was written by an American anthropologist by the name of Colin Turnbull. It's a little bit older. It's written in the 60s. I actually had to go to my local university's library to read it. And I'm going to have to get back to it. But the idea that, you know, music is extremely important to these people. And it plays a big part in their society. Now, we'll talk more about these peoples later when we get to next season. However, I know I mentioned at the start of this episode that there may have been other groups that just have not passed on DNA to their descendants, or they may have been, you know, we just can't find evidence of them, but they may still have descendants. Now, there is another group of pygmies that do not live in the, at least in the Congo Basin, in the same region that these people or these people's ancestors are living in. Now, I mentioned them a little bit last season, and these people are referred to as the West African hunter-gatherers. And they probably moved up from the coast of West Africa right around 10,000 BC or so. And they kind of pushed a little bit more upriver inland. They would be in places like southern Nigeria, Ghana, Togo, the Côte d'Ivoire, those kind of regions. And they were probably very likely pygmy people, though they may have been closer to the Twa in height. We're not 100% sure. And they may have been related to groups living in Central Africa. They may have belonged to the ancestors of the Mbega, excuse me. I was drawing a blank on which one was the Eastern and which one was the Western group. They may have shared common ancestors with those people, and some of their groups migrated to the northwest and then eventually north. You see a kind of a slow buildup of the population, and you find more red ochre art, tools, things like that. And these tools appear to have close similarities, at least, with some of the tools used by the people in the kind of the Central African region. Now, they are not... They're probably moving here first. There may have been some archaic Homo sapiens that we don't have a firm genetic record of, that they may have been interacting with, intermarrying. Perhaps ancestors of some peoples who would eventually move north into the Green Sahara. And, but these people remained along the kind of the southern coast of West Africa, whereas, you know, people in the Sahara moved north into the Green Sahara region. Now, whatever the exact case, one of the big things that's happening this season is that you're going to see more migrations south from people moving down from the slowly desertifying Sahara region. So these people are trying, of course, to move to regions that are a little bit more hospitable, maybe to kind of ease some of the population drain on the resources. And that's going to be one of the big focuses for the next episode. And again, probably for next season as well in this region. The slow immigration of Saharan peoples down to this region, and then their adoption of agriculture, and then again their expansions out of their agricultural bases, their initial agricultural regions. And one of the things that's going to be happening is them driving the Western hunter-gatherers to either extinction or completely absorbing them, which it appears that mostly that they were just killed off with some, I'm sure, intermarriage or, assimilation. And this is backed up by myths or, stories told by some of these groups. They do talk about how they encountered these little people living in various places, and that they had kind of built homes into the hills and the rocks and those kind of places, caves near where these people were beginning to practice their slightly more settled agricultural lifestyles. And we'll talk about this some next time. That's not to say that all the people living in West Africa that were West African hunter-gatherers were pygmy migrants. There were probably some that were, ancestors of peoples who had moved north to the Sahara. That's all stuff that we're going to dive into next week. But yeah, so that's kind of this episode. I do recommend Colin Turnbull's book, The Forest Peoples. It's very easy to read, despite being a very heady anthropological text. You will get spoilers for future events that are going to be happening to the Pygmy peoples, but I do recommend it. It's very good. And you can probably find it, if you're in college, definitely you could find it at your college library. Otherwise, you'd probably have to request it specifically from like a larger regional library if you're like in a smaller town. I don't know if you'd be able to find a copy in like a small town. So, but yeah, so I think that's kind of a good place to start, stop this week. Had a little bit more to talk about, with the Pygmy peoples. And again, that I know some people think that's kind of a pejorative term, but the various groups, they don't seem to particularly care about it. They obviously face discrimination for their stature, unjustly so. The people discriminating against them don't call them pygmies. They call them by their names. In some cases, the names that I've used are the names given to them by their agricultural neighbors. And we'll talk about this, but there's a lot of cases where they are exploited by their agricultural natives. But in some cases, the Pygmies are able to get, something of a upper hand in some types of negotiations. But it is a very difficult life for them. And in fact, a lot of modern apparatuses in these places do discriminate against them. They can't, in some places, I think, get driver's licenses or like identification papers. It's very difficult for them in some of these areas to enter into the state's, networks or, social securities, not social security like we have in the U.S., but, to get any kind of governmental support. So they do have to rely on a lot of help from outsiders or just, you know, neighbors who are sympathetic to them. And that is, I think, fairly sad. And it's a tough situation. I think some of the Twa people were caught up in the Rwandan genocides in the 90s. Some of those peoples were targeted, along with other ethnic groups, of course. But that's all stuff we'll talk about in the future. Yeah. So, thank you all for listening. I hope you have enjoyed. I hope you found this episode informative. I hope you're looking forward to us continuing talking about Africa. Any questions or feedback, please feel free to reach out to me at waragrevpod@gmail.com. You can also direct message me on Twitter/X. You can also comment on any of the YouTube videos. I do live stream most of the week, sometimes on the weekends as well. You can drop in if I'm live, chat there, ask questions there. I always appreciate everyone coming by. We're almost to 125 subscribers on YouTube, and the numbers are going pretty strong in this new year. We've broken 150 every month, I believe, so far, and well over that and a couple others. So I'm hoping with this week we might get 250 for this month. But we'll see. Regardless, I appreciate everyone who's listening, and I hope you will continue to do so. Thank you all, and you all have a great evening and a good rest of your week. Thank you all. Goodbye.